From CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Ira Nadell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. This evening, Professor Eve Poudrier of the UBC School of Music, an expert in the area of rhythm and music cognition. Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here as well.
I want to start with this term, musical cognition. It can mean everything and something. How do you understand it?
I think music cognition is really about understanding what are the mechanisms behind how we perceive music. So when we listen to music, we either feel like we want to move to it, or we maybe have some emotions that emerge. Maybe a piece of music is connected with some past event or something in our life, or maybe we just think it's dread awful and it just sounds like noise to us. And obviously, these different perceptions come from some mechanisms that we have in our brain that are set up to respond to music in a certain way. So music cognition is really about trying to understand better how the brain and the mind participate in the musical experience.
But are we aware of this at the time? If we both listen to the same piece of music, we will probably respond differently.
I think so. I mean, I think that our past experience and our cultural background and even just the specific nature of our engagement with music does modulate the way we perceive music. But on some fundamental levels, I think all human beings respond to music in some way, or most people do. And there are certain generalizations that we can make about that perception. I think that for a long time, at least people who studied psychology of music were looking for universal laws of perception. And it was discovered that, well, there are some principles that we can guide our understanding. But yes, the experience of different individuals is very different. And actually, that really interests me very much. And the field has moved toward trying to understand that better. So studying music perception and cognition in children and elderly and people who have disabilities or, people with Alzheimer's, for example, or children with that are in the autism spectrum. And I think we can learn even more about ourselves by studying how different people will react to the same music.
Okay, but what about different composers? So mm-hmm. If we listen to Bach, there's one form of musical cognition, and if we listen to Elton John, there's another, or Celine Dion.
Maybe. So there's some things that would be similar in those three different, musical sources you're talking about. So for one thing, something that really interests me in terms of rhythm is that probably all these three different, musical experiences will bring your body to engage with them in some way. In the field, in the jargon, we call that sensory motor synchronization. And that's something very simple, is that when we perceive some kind of regularity in outside of us, our body tends to align itself with that. So if we're talking together and we might start adopting a similar pace, if we're walking together, we might start synchronizing our walk together. When we listen to music, our body will do that as well. It will synchronize with what seems to be regular moments in the music. And that would be true in Bach as well as in Elton John or Celine Dion.
Okay, and the body then responds with the tapping, with
could
the
be tapping.
Moving my shoulders,
yeah.
Or my desire to stand up and start dancing.
Yeah, yeah.
This is
yeah.
part of that response.
Yes, this is part of that response. And it's something that is not unique to human beings, but it's something that is shared by, pretty much most human beings, as far as we know, and by some species in the animal kingdom. So it has raised the interest of people who are interested in the evolution, evolution theory. So it's quite an interesting aspect of our response to music.
But does our response evolve? Do we educate ourselves? And so the response of a person, let's pick a number, 45, is different than a person who's 15?
Yes, I think so. So research has shown that, there's quite a difference. So young people tend to prefer a faster pace music than older people. If you are musically trained, that will also modulate your response very much. So we know that musicians, for example, are much more able to detect timing variations that are very small. And at the same time, they're very resilient to it. And that makes sense, because imagine you might have played in the band in high school, and if your neighbor messes up his part or her part, you want to ignore that and not start playing in time with what is, not the right beat. So musicians have developed this ability to be very resilient. They also tend to pick a regular beat that is slower than people who are non-musicians. And we think that that's because they have a mental representation of the rhythmic structure that has more levels to it, so that they're able to kind of synchronize at a slower pace.
I'm thinking back to my earlier career as the original drummer of Sonny and His Rhythm Kings, which you have not heard of, I know. But we had great fun, and I do recall moments that you just described when there's been a little misstep, shall we say, in performance, and how you compensate for that.
Yeah.
I did not continue, by the way. I just want to go on the record.
But that experience is part of you, and it would probably change the way that you listen to similar music than the music that you've played before. You were the drummer?
Yes.
So you might, cue into what the drummer is doing in a particular way. And that experience would probably be different than if you had most experience with playing the guitar, for example. So, all of these things make a difference.
I tried the trumpet, but I was unsuccessful, let me tell you. Now, I know that one of the critical figures, composers, in terms of your own musical development, was Elliot Carter.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about his music, and what was it about Elliot Carter's compositions that were so important?
Yeah. So I discovered, my training was as a classical pianist before I went to the Graduate Center to do my PhD. So I didn't know a lot about American modernist composers. So I took a course on modernist composition, and Carter was one of the three figures we focused on. The others were Ligeti and Birtwistle. And Carter is an interesting composer. First, he's lived such a long life. I mean, he was born in 1908. He passed away just a few years after having lived over 100 years old. And he was very active in the last 15, 20 years of his career. When I first listened to Carter, it was to his big orchestral works. And frankly, it sounded like a big mess. It was very complex rhythm. Lots of different things are superposed. And it was not that attractive to me. But then I started listening to his works for solo piano and small ensembles, and I heard something that I had not heard really anywhere else that was quite unique. So Carter is very interested in what he thinks of as the human drama or the human experience. And some of these works for smaller ensembles, he's kind of come up with a particular way of writing them, where he imagines, let's say we have a trio, he imagines that each instrument in that trio is its own personality or has its own character. And the way that he expresses that musically is by using each domain in a slightly different way for each instrument. So maybe one instrument will play at a fast tempo, will have exuberant rhythmic gestures, and maybe use certain intervals or chords. And another instrument might play at a slightly slower tempo, will have more melancholic type of gestures. And the pieces that he writes are about the encounter of these different characters and how they interact with one another. They might be in agreement to some extent and then move away and not be in agreement. They might cooperate or non-cooperate. The narratives are not very specific. There's no program, but there's an idea of how these different characters interact. And when you listen to the music, the rhythm is very irregular, but in some of these works for small instrument, you really get a sense that you're hearing different things going on at the same time. One of the pieces that I first worked closely with was Elliot Carter's 90 Plus for piano. It's a birthday offering for a composer, Italian composer Petrossi, that was one of his friends. And the idea of the piece is that it was his 90th birthday, so the piece has 90 very slow beats that, go from the beginning to the end. And at the end, there's a few extra ones for many wishes for many more years. And each of these beats is extremely slow. It's 3 1/3 second between each of the beats. And against that, the piece has different episodes. And against that, you have another beat from which that help offer a contrasting layer to it. And there are moments in the piece where you can really hear that. You hear that there's something that's happening at a certain pace, and it's, you know, it's abstract. You might not know exactly what it is. And against that, you have some other living musical form that moves at quite a different speed.
Well, I think it's only appropriate we hear something by Elliot Carter. But surely what Carter is doing isn't absolutely new, is it?
It's not new. I mean, Carter is part of a generation of composers, you know, that came out of the kind of Western classical tradition who were all very interested in experimenting with rhythm and expanding the rhythmic horizon. I mean, the way that he did it is quite unique. And I think each composer came up with their own ways. I mean, you can think as far back as the 1930s and 40s. You have Conlon Nancarrow, another American composer who spent some time in Mexico, who was also interested in layering different rhythmic processes. So you might have one part that's accelerating against another part that is decelerating, for example. At the time where he was working, I think partially he might have felt that if you know, that a performer might not do exactly what he was thinking about, and I think there was some limitation also that were brought about by musical notation, which was not invented to write these kind of rhythms. So he actually did a whole series of studies for the player piano, which gave him complete control, obviously, on the performance. And, you know, so there's pieces like that that are very interesting as well.
What about people like Steve Reich? It seems to me with drumming,
yeah,
he's doing something analogous. I'm not saying it's identical. Even Philip Glass, in terms of what Glass does with rhythm.
Yeah.
Do you find parallels?
Yeah, there are parallels. So I think Steve Reich has, part of his influence comes from Western drumming music, where we also have what we call polyrhythms. This kind of music is an interesting case because the perception of the rhythmic structure from an insider's point of view, someone who actually is participating in making it, and someone from the outside from a different culture, like us, is very different. So often when we are we listen to this kind of Western African drumming ensembles, we feel that there are different layers that could be organized in different ways. Maybe this one groups into three and this one groups into two, and they're all kind of interlocking with one another. I had the opportunity to interact with Kofi Agawu from Princeton a few times, who is a music theorist and also an ethnomusicologist. And he makes a very strong point that from an African perspective or from an insider's perspective in some of these cultures, first, these pieces are often danced to, and everybody agrees that there's a very clear beat and there's one unifying beat that that all the parts obey to. But from an outsider perspective, that's not quite necessarily the same.
Is it reasonable to think that certain rhythms kind of help my brain or my understanding? Should I listen to music when I'm writing?
I can't say I'm an expert in that particular question, but I get abstracts from different journals, which I read on you. And I just read a study, which I can't tell the author because I looked at it so quickly on my iPhone in the bus, that actually listening to dissonant music was more distracting to performing certain tasks than to listening to consonant music that was harmonic. So obviously different types of music and sounds might affect your ability to perform a task at the same time in some different ways. For rhythm, we know that if the beat is regular, so then that will be less distracting than if the beat is irregular.
Yeah. So your work involves musicology, psychology, a bit of computer science.
A bit.
Are you in the right department?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. For me, it was very exciting when I got involved into music cognition, because I always had a strong penchant, if you want, for the science. And I'm a systematic thinker and worker in some ways. And that's probably how I ended up being a music theorist in the first place. But it was really exciting to discover this kind of experimental method and empirical methods. But my questions are always about music, while the questions of a psychologist really are about the human experience. And the questions of a neuroscientist are about the brain. And I think it's really wonderful that in music cognition, you have these different people who will come and collaborate with one another. And they come from different perspectives. The core questions are different, but music is at the heart of it. That's really quite wonderful.
This has been terrifically stimulating. It's a wonderful conversation. I'm really delighted to have you on the show. So many thanks to our guest, Professor Eve Proutier from the UBC School of Music. And stay tuned for future conversations with the always engaging members of UBC's Faculty of Arts. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.